Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do some systems, organizations, and people fall apart when faced with trauma and rapidly shifting conditions, while others manage to cope with the new realities and move on? In a world where changes seem to hit us faster than ever, my guest today is convinced it is crucial to understand the mechanisms that allow for adaptability and put in place measures that focus not only on preventing catastrophic events, but on surviving them. Andrew Zolli is director of the global innovation network PopTech and a former fellow of the National Geographic Society. His new book, written with Anne-Marie Healy, is called Resilience: Why Things Bounce Back. Andrew, welcome to Think.
It's great to be with you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
We should start by talking about the notion of resilience itself. Does your definition extend beyond the common understanding of the word?
Well, you know, one of the challenges in defining the term precisely is that many different fields use it to mean slightly different things. Ecologists mean the ability of an ecosystem to avoid being pushed past a critical threshold. Business leaders use it to mean continuity in the face of natural disaster or disruption. Psychologists use it to talk about how people can bounce back from potentially traumatic events. All of those different definitions focus on one or of two aspects of resilience, either the continuity or recovery in the face of disruption and change. The way that we describe it is the ability to persist and potentially even to thrive amid disruption.
What does it mean to preserve adaptive capacity?
Well, all systems have, whether we're talking about the economy that we live in, the societies that we live in, our communities, even our families and ourselves, have some natural latent ability to adapt to change. We are able to deal with moderate, sometimes even severe disruptions. And that capacity, you can think about that as a sort of independent aspect of any system or any individual organization or society. And sometimes over time, systems can become more brittle and lose their adaptive capacity. Over a long period of time, and if you think about a disruption like, we had this, the BP disaster in the Gulf would be a perfect example. Mm-hmm. The people didn't get up on the day of the disaster and say, we're going to make a bunch of really terrible decisions today and they're going to lead to this catastrophe. Instead, what you saw was the very slow erosion, thousands of tiny decisions to change the safety culture of an organization, to signal internally and externally that certain kinds of risks could be tolerated that might not be tolerated elsewhere. If people didn't get with that program, they were encouraged to find the door. And in environments like that, over a long period of time, the ability for a system like a company in that particular case to adapt to the disruption is slowly eroded. And then when a disruption comes, things fall apart.
And what was so interesting about that case, that Deepwater Horizon case, is that I think people in charge assumed there were multiple redundant safety measures in place and that they could not fail because they were covered.
That's right. That's right. We have a kind, and in fact, the story there is somewhat paradoxical because not only are there many instances where there aren't as many safety systems, we sort of awake to discover to our horror that there aren't good ways to plug a deep water spill or to deal with the unwinding of a financial institution at the center of the global financial crisis, or pick your favorite fill-in-the-blank issue. But there's another converse problem there, and that is that sometimes the systems we put in place to make systems safer actually make the situation more dangerous because they add to the net complexity of the system. Just earlier this month in France, air safety officials released a final report about one of the most mysterious and devastating airline crashes in French history. It was the crash of Air France Flight 447, which crashed on the way from Rio de Janeiro to Paris. Now, like many of these stories, what you heard from the safety officials was they blamed, operator error. They blamed the pilots, basically, at the center and said they made mistakes. But when you begin to unpack what happened, you find out that they were nested among thousands of systems, some of which were going wrong and some of which weren't. They were facing banks of alerts, some of which were incorrect and some of which were out of date and some of which were accurate, and in a matter of seconds had to deal with all that complexity. And in an environment like that, we're just prone to make a lot of mistakes. So sometimes it's willful blindness and sometimes it's complexity.
So you argue here that resilience is ultimately more desirable in many cases than sustainability, but it does seem that we have sort of a human bias to prefer sustainability.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my day job is running this organization called PopTech that brings together scientists and technologists and engineers and designers, and people working in many different fields and in many different kinds of companies and foundations. And over the course of the last few years, we've seen very quietly under the surface a really significant shift underway. And that is a shift away from risk mitigation, a belief that we can basically steer our ships around the storms that inevitably arise in human experience, and an increasing appreciation that that we have to build institutions and systems that can withstand them. And the reason for that it can best be explained by a metaphor. Imagine we take all the people who care about a big global issue like climate change would be a great example. We put them in a car and we send them heading toward the cliff of irrevocable change. Mm-hmm. Now, when the car is far from the cliff, the people who have the moral authority in the car say things like, stop, turn around, slow down, we are headed toward the cliff. But because prophets are rarely appreciated in their own time, and because the car is far from the cliff, they're rarely listened to, as the car gets closer to the cliff, a different group of people come to the fore, and they say things like, we had better put an airbag and some parachutes on this thing, because the system is going over, or could go over even if we hit the brakes. And they're right. That's the right appropriate thing to say at that time. The people in the former situation are really risk mitigationists. They're thinking about sustainability. The folks who are in the second category, when the car is close to the cliff, are risk adaptationists, and they're thinking about resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And the big headline here is that across many different systems, ecological, economic, social systems, we're just living in an era where we are closer and closer to the cliffs. And so it's not surprising to see this shift toward resilience. Now, it's a difficult shift, especially for environmentalists. For old school environmentalists, the word adaptation was verboten for years. Because if you said, we need to adapt to the effects of the crises that are evolving, you would take your focus off the people that they held originally responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And that is you lose the sort of moral high ground, but what you gain is in practicability and dealing with situations as they are. And we're just in an environment now where we have to deal with the situations as they are.
So I guess your point is not that we should throw up our hands and stop trying to mitigate risk. We just need to plan, have a sort of dual planning strategy.
That's exactly right. Sustainability doesn't go away. If you are pumping tons of carbon into the atmosphere, if you are eroding the adaptive capacity of people around the world, it's a good thing to stop. But we have to increasingly do something that is difficult, expensive, and hard to do, which is we also, at the same time, need to think about how to help people who are vulnerable deal with the disruptions. Just one really simple example of this. In East Africa, where you have folks who are in a circumstance where they are much more vulnerable to the effects of climate change than we are here in the U.S. because they have fewer resources to deal with them. The vast majority of the farmers who are working in East Africa are smallholder farmers. They farm plots of land that are an acre or two at most. And when climate change arrives, and it has already arrived, so this is not a future tense risk, this is a present tense reality for them, it changes the pattern of what crops will grow, what pests arrive, and most importantly, when the rains come. And if the rains come at the wrong time, they are one crop away from being pushed off their land, which leads to real fundamental food insecurity and other forms of insecurity, including, because the vast majority of these farmers are women and girls, a real reversal of the limited, fragile gains that have been made against the things like the Millennium Development Goals for women and girls. So what's interesting is to see how new technologies are beginning to address this problem. There's a fantastic initiative there called Kilimo Salama, which uses mobile phones and wireless weather sensors to deliver agricultural microinsurance to smallholder farmers. When the farmers buy their crop, and they're usually buying like 5 pounds worth of seeds, it's a small amount of inputs, they purchase on their mobile phones and a small insurance premium on those seeds. And if there's too much weather, if everywhere there is a wireless station that connects their cell phone, there's also a weather station. And the moment there's too little rain or too much rain at the wrong time, they instantaneously get a payout on their mobile phone. That's actually a huge new market for the delivery of insurance services. The market has been estimated at 1 billion people on Earth, less than 3% of whom are served. But we're going to see lots more things like that to help, mechanisms to help people cope.
So let's talk about responsiveness to information in a rapidly changing situation. Just as you explained earlier, there are sort of multiple ways to define resilience. There are multiple ways that systems and individuals put things in place to be resilient. The thing they have in common, though, is what you call tight feedback systems.
Yeah, one of the central challenges of resilience in general, first of all, it's what makes a system resilient is often very context-specific, so it's hard to come up with the 7 R's of resilience.
Right.
But there's a kind of general, if there's a general truth about resilient systems, one of them is that they use data and information really well. There are good feedback mechanisms. We have a situation where our daily life, if the more successful we become in life, the wealthier we become, the more those feedbacks of our actions are hidden. We don't see the environmental consequences. We don't see the social consequences of the systems that we are building. So, you know, a person who, a college student who goes and buys a joint from somebody in their dorm doesn't see the global drug trade. Somebody who's operating a power plant doesn't see global climate change. Those systemic effects are hidden from us. And so one of the ways to build resilience is to make the feedbacks much clearer and to collect better data. And a great example of this goes actually the perfect follow-up to the last example, also uses mobile phones. Across much of the global south, in places like sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia, people use their mobile phones, but they don't pay at the end of the month. They pay at the beginning. Mm-hmm. They buy credits and then they spend them down. Well, it turns out that the unit of the denomination that they use to buy credits in is a very good indication, a proxy for their economic health. So, for example, if I were topping up my mobile phone in $5 increments and suddenly all my neighbors started topping up my mobile phone in 50-cent increments, it's a very good early warning system that something has actually started to happen. And researchers have started to use this data to get much better real-time feedbacks about a system, how it's performing and how it's behaving.
Andrew Zolli is my guest this hour. He's director of the Global Innovation Network, PopTech, and former fellow of the National Geographic Society. We're discussing his new book, Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew Zolli, who directs the global innovation network PopTech and is author of the new book Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Andrew, if, as you mentioned, those at sort of the bottom who are affected by problems that may have been generated far away have the best information about what's happening on the ground, does that also suggest they are in some ways best positioned to do something about those problems, at least to the extent that they are affected?
Well, certainly it's the case that one of the kind of central patterns of resilience is empowering the local. Sometimes, however, it's really about connecting local information with people who can act upon it who may not be in the local community. So a great example of this is what happened in the wake of the 2010 Haitian earthquake. Mm-hmm. This was an absolutely profoundly devastating earthquake, and a response to it emerged that was genuinely surprising, that was based on a global community of people who are connected very loosely via social media all over the world to people who were actually on the ground. So within 96 hours, a group of graduate students, actually at Tufts University up in Massachusetts, had deployed a very special tool called Ushahidi. It's a mapping platform that allows ordinary citizens to report incidents within a larger crisis context. This is called crowdsourced crisis mapping, and have that information mapped on a singular Google map where everybody could see what was going on. They built and deployed a system within 96 hours, actually, that allowed people who were in the rubble and who were in this very terrible situation, but whose cell phones were working, to report from the ground where urgently needs were not being met or where things were urgently needed. That information was texted via mobile phones from the rubble of buildings where people were trapped to a group of Haitian diaspora ordinary citizens who were living in the United States and elsewhere, translated from Haitian Creole into English, sent on to this central map, sent then to first responders who responded in English, sent back to the Haitian Creole translators, and then sent back to the folks who were on the ground and in distress. And this incredible platform emerged as a global collaboration between technology engineers and crisis mappers and first responders and members of the Haitian diaspora and, of course, people on the ground who could be tied together using social media in a way that just a few years ago they couldn't. So it's really about connecting that and involving real communities who are living with disruption on the ground to sources of innovation. Another great example of this actually comes from here in the United States. In Chicago, as you may know, some of your listeners may know, the south side of Chicago is one of the most violent places in the world. In 2007, there were more gun deaths per capita on the south side of Chicago than there were in Kabul or Baghdad. Mm. And your chances of being affected by gun violence are very, very high. And a pioneering program run by an epidemiologist named Gary Slutkin uses an epidemiological approach to tackling the problem of gun violence through the community. So what they do is they train formerly incarcerated and otherwise unemployable senior drug and gang-level operatives who are guys, street-level guys, who know exactly firsthand what the consequences of gun violence are, to become what are called violence interrupters. And they will intervene in a potential shooting, often at the point when the guns are drawn. And according to the Department of Justice, this community-led approach lowers the violent crime rate, or can lower the violent crime rate, in its first year of operation by up to 75%. And the reason for that is not just because of the exceptional training that these violence interrupters get, but it's because they are credible messengers with credible messages, and they're in the community. They're able to do things that the police could not do. And so an engaged community with the right tool set can do extraordinary things to build their resilience.
And this idea that resilient systems have certain responses to crisis at the ready that only kick into action when absolutely necessary is actually something that's duplicated in nature, or that I suppose we might copy from nature.
Yes, that's right. You know, when you think about these big abstract systems that we think about, this is incalculably large systems like the global economy or the global financial system, for example, they're really beyond the control of anybody. That's the big secret. The big secret is that the regulators who are charged with regulating them often have data that's, you know, very mildly out of date, which means that they're frequently driving by looking in the rearview mirror. They're trying to figure out what to do based on what happened, not on good indicators about what's going to happen. And so researchers who study big complex systems are looking at other examples of self-regulation, in this case taken from the natural world, and looking to apply it in new ways to things like the financial system. So a group of researchers have been looking particularly at the way that coral reefs self-regulate. Coral reefs are beautiful. You know, you've seen the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. You know, these incredibly beautiful, complex systems that are constantly buffeted by environmental forces beyond their control. And a group of pioneering ecologists, led by a guy named David Bellwood, discovered recently something really fascinating about the Great Barrier Reef. The way that reefs work is they have two dominant states. There's a state of being, which is the kind of thing you'd like to look at when you go snorkeling, which is the beautiful, rich, diverse corals and fish. And they have another state, which is the one you wouldn't want to see, which is an algae-dominated state in which the biodiversity has become a monoculture and the algae has taken over. Now, there's some algae in the healthy state, the coral-dominated state, that the fish who live on the reef need to eat, and it's embedded inside of corals, actually. It helps photosynthesize. The corals have a symbiotic relationship with this algae. But if it grows unchecked, it can basically blot out, change the chemistry of the reef and basically kill off all the diversity. So it's something that's needed in small amounts but deadly in large amounts. And it turns out that just recently, Bellwood and his colleagues discovered a certain species of fish called the pinnate batfish, which is a beautiful little black and white fish, very, very lovely, and under normal circumstances, very boring. Doesn't do very much. It just sort of sits there, and it mostly eats coral. And yet, when a tipping point is coming that separates the coral-dominated state from the algae-dominated state, this little fish will change its behavior and begin to eat very specifically forms of algae that accelerate the transition. Essentially, they act as a baked-in insurance policy that is released only when a tipping point is nearing. And now, financial regulators are looking for the financial equivalents of the batfish. And they may have found one, actually, interestingly. We're spending a lot of time these days talking about what's going on in Europe. They may have found one in this extraordinary new currency called the vir. The vir is it's a currency in Switzerland, and it emerged out of the Great Depression when there was a currency crisis in Switzerland, and all of a sudden companies couldn't get access to money, and therefore their ability to operate was being was drying up. They created this complementary currency in which they called the vir, which is tradable and exchangeable for Swiss francs or for euros. And when times are good, nobody uses it. But when times are bad and suddenly there's a currency crisis, these businesses will switch into the vir, and they still use it to this day. About 25% of businesses take this currency, and it helps offset shocks to the dominant system. And the central lesson of those two examples, the coral reef example and the currency example, is that resilience is predicated very frequently on diversity. You want more than one system able to deal with a crisis at the same time. And having them baked into the system imposes a cost. They don't come for free, and they reduce the overall efficiency of the system in some ways. But they're exactly the kinds of policies you want to have there and not have to invent on the spot when a crisis comes.
What can we learn about the organization of global terrorist groups about resiliency?
Well, sometimes resilience is predicated on and found in organizations we loathe, not just ones we love.
Yeah.
And one of the we spent a lot of time looking at this one particular local chapter of Al Qaeda called Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Interestingly, the scourge of terrorism is in many ways similar in its operations and achieves resilience using some of the same mechanisms that a bug like tuberculosis uses in your body. That is to say, for long periods of time, groups like Al Qaeda are actually good at reducing their overall metabolism. When they're not actively planning to blow things up, they don't do very much. And that's one of the reasons they're hard to detect, because you could be looking at a group of people, and the difference between the terrorist and the non-terrorist in that group is it has to do with the intention in their mind. And it's just hard to detect people's future intentions when they're not physically making them happen. Similarly, tuberculosis in your body is carried by about 1 in 3 people on Earth, is also latent for long periods of time. And just like terror networks, tuberculosis needs to then explosively pop up so that it can transmit itself. Its transmission mechanism is to sort of concentrate in the body, have this explosive moment, and then come out when it's expelled and coughed out. And a very similar dynamic is true of terrorists. Terrorists, in some ways, when they engage in terrorism, not only are they achieving their aims, but they're also advertising and attracting recruits with their attacks. And interestingly, now there are groups in the U.S. military who are beginning to use public health models for reducing the threat of terrorism. They're using the same tools that you would use to go after a disease like tuberculosis, which involves using a network to fight a network and adopting some of the same techniques and organizational structures, the improvisation and very rapid response and highly networked approach that the terrorists use against them.
That's really interesting, because just like our biological enemies, we have learned over the past decade, certainly, that our human enemies are able to be a lot more nimble than our large structures designed to take them down.
That's right. I mean, if you think about the way that the current military, the way the military is organized, we build battleships, and when we send a gigantic battleship into the Straits of Hormuz or into the Gulf or wherever, it's a giant advertisement for American power. It's a huge platform for projecting force, but it's an asymmetric expression. It doesn't take very much. All you have to do is put a little pinprick in the balloon and show that it's vulnerable, and that advertisement becomes ineffective. In many cases, you know, you might as well just put a big bullseye on the destroyer, you know, on the aircraft carrier, because you don't have to do very much to harm it. To show that it's even modestly harmable reduces the projection of force. And so places like the Naval Postgraduate Center in Monterey, there are researchers like John Arquilla, is a wonderful example, who are basically promoting the idea that what we need to do is become very much like the kinds of forces that we encounter, which is nimble, culturally literate, highly agile, reconfigurable, and that we should be using technologies to basically become more nimble and more agile than our competitors.
Why are some of the greatest failures and catastrophes in recent history such a surprise to us? You know, you think about something like Hurricane Katrina, and it really represents a whole system of fail-safe measures that worked until they catastrophically did not, and the whole thing snowballed.
Well, that's certainly true. There is a term we introduce in the book, and that resilience researchers use. It was coined by a man named John Doyle at Caltech, called robust yet fragile systems.
Right.
And the way that robust yet fragile systems work is could probably best be explained by a metaphor. So let's say that your great uncle Larry passes away, and you get a call one day from his estate, and they say, "We've got a beautiful tree farm here for you. he left this to you in his will, but the will stipulates that you have to go try to make a run of it to try and make it work in order to inherit it. And you say, well, you know, the economy's bad. I'm going to go off and try this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you plant all the trees in your little one-acre grid fairly far apart, then they will be safer in the threat that you may face from, say, a lightning strike and a forest fire, which is a very natural occurrence. So that arrangement of trees in a tree forest where you might separate them by, you know, 15 feet or so their canopies don't touch, so that a spark in one doesn't cause a spark in the other,
yeah,
is very robust, but it's not very efficient. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you could plant a tree every 15, you know, inches,
mm-hmm,
which would use every single bit of land, but a spark somewhere could easily cause a fire everywhere. So there you're getting peak efficiency, but you're also getting peak fragility. Now, you're smarter than either of these approaches. You want to balance the robustness that comes with the safety and the efficiency that comes from planting things very closely. So instead, what you do is you put in a series of groves and roads and compensatory mechanisms that let you get into the interior of your tree farm, pull all the trees out when it's harvest time, and balance the effects of a potential, you know, reduce the risk but not eliminate it completely. And right about this time, you may come up with, after a lot of work, the perfect design for your tree farm as regards the threat of forest fires. And it may be just at that moment that you discover that an invasive species of beetle has hitchhiked its way on your boot leg, mm, and brought you into a thing. These systems are good at dealing with anticipated risks, but bad at dealing with unanticipated risks. And that's much of what we see.
Andrew Zolli is my guest. He directs the global innovation network PopTech, and he's a former fellow of the National Geographic Society. We're speaking this hour about his new book, written with Anne-Marie Healy, called Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew Zolli, who directs the global innovation network PopTech and is author of the new book Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Andrew, given a world where resilience will continue to have ever greater importance, what does that suggest about the nature of leadership in the 21st century and beyond?
It's a great question. You know, the thing we found, really surprisingly, when we found resilience in many different contexts, was that often the way we talk about leaders in our society is we often talk about the square-jawed, broad-shouldered CEO or president or whomever, and we talk about the passionate, bottom-up activist. And interestingly, what we found is that resilient systems and resilient organizations, resilient societies, were often their resilience rested on a middle layer. It was a kind of, instead of top-down or bottom-up, it was a kind of middle-out model. And now the funny thing is, in American business and society, we basically gutted that layer. You know, we only see middle management when we make fun of it in Dilbert cartoons. we don't really see it all that much. But what we found often were these folks who were not at the top. They were kind of one or two levels down. And what they did was what the network researcher Val Descrebe calls network weaving. Their job was to weave together constituencies that don't normally talk or work together. And a great example of that actually comes from South Africa. In rural KwaZulu-Natal, there's a, first of all, to understand this, this is a part of South Africa where the HIV infection rate among adults is about 40%. Mm. So imagine, you know, every adult you see today, every other one of them is infected with HIV. It's a disease that is of, it's a heterosexual, broad-scale disease that affects everybody in the population. There aren't nearly enough doctors and clinical context to take care of that disease burden. And one of the reasons that people don't come in and get treated early is because of the stigma associated with having other people know your status. So one of the challenges is that people come into the clinical context sometimes with 6 weeks to live, and you know there's an 8-week waiting list to see a physician, and people will literally pass away while waiting to see a doctor because the system is so overburdened. And there is an amazing organization called iTeach. It's run by a Western doctor named Krista Dong and a Zulu woman named Zini Tebete. And they run an organization designed to amplify the effectiveness of this very overburdened system. Now, they're not running the hospital. They're not the head of public health for the region. They're in the middle of the system. And what they've done is really amazing. They've reached out to a class of people who were never consulted or never thought to be part of the healthcare system, who are traditional healers. Traditional healers, they're called Sangomas in South African society, and about 85% of South Africans will see a Sangoma if something goes wrong with their health. And their theory of healthcare is based on ancestors. So if you have something wrong with you, it's because there's you've got some relationship wrong with your ancestors, so here's a ritual to do. And this was how health was practiced in South Africa for millennia before colonization. And so the Western healthcare system and the traditional healthcare system were basically at odds with each other. They didn't trust each other. And because Krista and Zini represented both a Westerner and somebody who was local to the culture and raised in the culture, they were able to forge a bridge between these two very hostile camps and get a network of traditional healers trained to become field pathologists. So they would, when they would see somebody in the community, they would say, you know, I do ancestors, I don't do germs. You look like you actually have some AIDS-defining illnesses. Here's a piece of paper to take you to the front of the line. And here's a way for you to get treatment that is outside of outside of your community and the next community where people won't know you, so that we reduce the issues of stigma. It's those kinds of connections between otherwise disconnected groups, having the right bridges in place, that often makes a system resilient when a big disruption comes.
Yeah, so rather than wishing away a system that may be very robust and in place for decades, there's a way to convert it so that it works with the present situation.
That's right. And in fact, actually, the interesting thing was among the rituals that that a Sangoma might prescribe for you are rituals in which there's a ritual act of vomiting. And it's part of the spiritual belief system of the local community. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge with this is that that one of the really important things about treating HIV is you have to take your medications every day at the same time. And often what would happen is people who would engage in these rituals that involved literally vomiting up their medication after they'd taken them. So they were able to say to the Sangomas, we don't want you to stop doing those rituals. What we want you to do is to figure out exactly what time, how long after someone has taken their medication, doing that ritual won't interfere with their other Western antiretroviral medication. So working out those kind of very specific local connections built enormous amounts of trust. And one of the most important things about these two communities is that the for them, building bridges meant, as it often means in many cultures, eating a lot together. They just went to countless barbecues together. South Africans love barbecue. They're called braais. And they just went to countless braais to build up the connections and to show that that their intent on both sides was really genuine.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dana on the line in Irving. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to ask a question about the sustainability of resilience, or perhaps even the resilience of resilience. As a child, I had many terrible, dramatic things happen to me, and I was one of those, oh, you're a survivor, and all these great things, and I was very resilient. And as I get older, I find that I don't have that resilience. Things hit me over and over, and I don't bounce back like I used to from dramatic events, you know, a death of a child or a parent or, you know, a loss of a job or something. I just, is there a science to, or anything to explain how resilience falls off, or is that something that you've seen in the past?
It's such a great question, and we did lots of work in collecting research on this very subject. The answer is that if you look at people's resilience over time, there is absolutely an age effect. Our ability to deal with potentially dramatic potentially traumatic events in life does drop off. But the story of what makes us resilient is very complex. So, you know, your genes, your physical health, the scope of your social network, the quality of your intimate relationships all have a dramatic effect on your personal resilience. But there are a couple of things that really affect it. There's a researcher named George Bonanno at Columbia, and he did population studies. He started actually with older Americans who had lost a spouse after a very long marriage, and then went on to study people who dealt with other forms of trauma, like being in the towers on 9/11. And what he found was that regardless of the context, somewhere between a third and two-thirds of people seem to have a natural level of psychological resilience. They're not affected over the long term. It doesn't mean they're not sad in the short term, but it means that they return to psychological health without a lot of deep intervention, without medications or therapy or other forms of help. For people who need that additional help, there are all of the traditional tools are available, but there are a few things that can actually deeply bolster our personal resilience. One of them is our belief system. A psychologist named Kenneth Pargament has been studying the effects of our beliefs about the world and about ourselves on our resilience, and what he found was that there's a whole field of what's called hardiness research, and what he found is that people who believe that the world is a meaningful place, believe that their actions have agency, and that they can make meaningful change in their lives, and that successes and failures are not put in their lives as random events, but they're there to teach them things, tend to have more psychological resilience than those that don't. And this may explain, among other things, why systems of faith have persisted in the American human experience, for such a long time, because they may confer some adaptive advantage on us regardless of what we believe, regardless of the specifics. But the most interesting thing, and this has been shown recently both for young people and for older people in two completely different studies, was that mindfulness training practices, cognitive-based mental habit formation and mental habit training can have a huge impact on how we prepare ourselves psychologically and deal with disruptions when they occur. This started by studying the brains of actively meditating Buddhist monks by a guy named Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. It has since been secularized, and now these tools of mindfulness training are being used with emergency room physicians, firefighters, active duty military officers, and literally just last week, a team at Emory University reported extraordinary outcomes from compassion-based cognitive therapy, teaching, in this case, foster children in the Georgia foster system. New mental habits had a huge impact on their resilience. These have also been used, shown to have great effectiveness with older Americans, with older people. And the good news about all of this is that there are things we can do that are free, they're highly portable, they're highly scalable, to bolster our resilience even as we get older and lose some of that elasticity.
And it makes perfect sense to do it, again, before a crisis occurs, because every one of us is going to ultimately experience something that really knocks us over.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a truism of human life that we can't see the things that are going to be surprises, because otherwise they wouldn't be surprises. And no life is without its inevitable vicissitudes and ups and downs. And we're very respectful of that fact, and have to be increasingly respectful of it as these things come more and more. And it's certainly true that there are things we can do now when we're in periods that aren't as disruptive to help us better process, particularly the emotional content of disruptions when they occur, that can have a huge impact on our long-term resilience, on the incidence of things like PTSD and long-term chronic depression.
Andrew, how can we determine when it's no longer useful to try and restore a particular environment or set of conditions to its previous state, but that we need to accept that certain undesirable changes are irreversible and we need to find ways to live with them?
Well, this is maybe it's a really, really important question. And in some ways, it is not an answerable question, because at the end of the day, what you're talking about are political questions. And the story there is nuanced. For example, when is it appropriate for us to try to bolster the vulnerability of, bolster the resilience of vulnerable people? And when should we pluck out the thorn that is the cause of that vulnerability? When is the moment when we decide that the thing that is causing the circumstance of vulnerability is the thing that needs to be changed?
Right.
That is ultimately a question of politics. It's a question of power. It's a question of social change and leadership. And so there isn't a singular answer to that question, but it haunts this whole conversation.
And what elements do we really need to be focusing on when we try to learn from past successes and failures or from conditions in nature and how they've played out?
Well, I think there's a few things. First of all, you know, since there is no single silver bullet and there is no single recipe, every day is day one. We can do things to bolster our resilience in the future. There are things we can do at our personal level, at our community level. But what we see is that the mix of what leads to the greatest resilience is healthy people. There's psychologically and physically healthy people with strong local networks, social networks, and strong community ties. And so often the things that we're doing, they don't look like we're building a resilience when we're doing things like building a community garden in an urban center. But what you're planting there are not just seeds in the sense of growing your vegetables. You're also planting the seeds of relationships that are going to be enormously powerful. You know, just to pick one example, in a recent study of women who were suffering from breast cancer, their survivability rates over 5 years skyrocketed when they were able to confide in a close friend. They almost quadrupled. And so it's in those relationships and with each other that we often find our resilience.
Andrew Zolli is director of PopTech and author of the new book Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. Andrew, fascinating topic. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, download the free daily podcast, and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. Our email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.